It's Beta Reader Matchup Time again, where you can be matched up with those writing in the same genre and or time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs. Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 4th of May, with the matchup emails going out on the 5th of May. Because my new novel, A Most Puzzling Murder, pubs in early June and will be keeping me very busy, this will be the last matchup until the fall. Please spread the word, even if you aren't signing up this time. The more writers we have registered, the better the matchups will be, which means you'll be paying it forward to your fellow authors, and hopefully they'll do the same when the time comes for you to register. For more information, head to biancamurray.com and go to the Beta Reader matchup page. Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. Hi everyone. Today we have an incredibly special guest joining us. She is the New York Times bestselling author of Dear Edward, which has sold in 27 territories and has been adapted into an Apple TV series that aired in 2023. She is also the author of the novels A Good Hard Look and Within Arm's Reach. She received an MFA from New York University and has taught fiction writing from Brooklyn's College MFA program, New York University's School of Continuing and Professional Studies, and for Gotham Writers Workshop. She was longlisted for the Simpson Joyce Carol Oates Literary Prize. She lives in Brooklyn with her husband and two children. It is my incredible pleasure to welcome Anne Napolitano. Anne, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
I've been trying forever to get you on the show. When I first read Hello Beautiful, so for everybody watching on our YouTube channel, this is the incredible book we're discussing today. When I first read this, when it came out, I was blown away. I listened to it on audio. I read the book. I actually first started it on audio and loved it so much that I was like, I need to read these sentences on the page. So then I bought a physical copy and I was listening to the two backwards and forwards, and I tried to get an interview then and I wasn't able to. So when your publicist reached out recently and said, would you like to have Anne on? It was a wonderful excuse to read the book again.
Okay.
And it's amazing how rereads just emphasize different things that you didn't notice the first time. So for our listeners, for the books that you love, I would highly recommend you reread, and don't even wait a year or two in between the reread. Sometimes just a month or two is all you need to dive back in. So I'm going to read the flap copy for those of you who've been living under a rock and don't know what this book is about. So here we go. Best friends and sisters, the four Padovano girls are seen as inseparable by everyone in their close-knit Italian-American neighborhood. Julia, the eldest, is the rocket of the family. She always has a destination in mind and clear plans for how to get there. Sylvie is happiest with her nose in a book, dreaming of the kind of love you only read about in literature. Cecilia and Emmeline, the twins, are the artist and the caregiver. From childhood, the four sisters complete one another. When Julia falls in love with William Waters, a history student and college sports star, she's delighted by the way her plans for adulthood are coming to fruition. A husband, a house, a family of her own. But when darkness from William's past begins to block the light of his future, it's Sylvie, not Julia, who becomes his closest confidant, and the ensuing betrayal tears the sisters apart. So who better to have on the podcast to talk about the long game of writing than you? Because I remember seeing Dear Edward everywhere at the time, read it, loved it, was obsessed with it, and thought this is an incredible debut novel from someone who is having immense overnight success. And then I did some research on you and realized, okay, no, that was not the case. Your journey to publication was quite long. That was not your first book, and that you'd had quite a bit of rejection along the way. So can you take us through that?
Sure. Yeah. So Dear Edward came out when I was 48 years old, and it was my third published novel. And I wrote two novels in my 20s that were not published. So I wrote my first novel while I was getting an MFA at New York University in the 90s. And I sent it out to agents, said the section of it that you send out, and 80 agents rejected it. And so I ended up putting it in a drawer. And I went out, I got a job working as personal assistant to support myself after having an MFA, and I wrote another novel. And I sent that one out, and I was like 27 years old at this point. I am basically a novelist. I mean, I never say never, but I can't write short fiction. So I had not published anything up until this point in my life, despite like devoting myself to becoming a writer. So when I was 27, I finished the second novel. I sent it out to agents. I had three agents that wanted to represent me. I was very excited. I chose the one that I felt, you know, the best fit for me. And she sent that novel out to publishers and no one bought it. There was like one editor who almost bought it, but like her boss went on maternity leave. And so she wasn't able to complete the deal or whatever. And so I put that novel in a drawer too. And at that point, I got really depressed, basically, where I was just like, well, this is not working. My father was sending me brochures for law school in the mail. He paid for me to take a very expensive all day long career aptitude test to try to find some other career for me. And the result of that test told me that I should be a park ranger. Yeah, I lived in New York City. It was not particularly outdoorsy. So like, it just made me more depressed because I was like, my God, there's like nothing I am suited for at all. I was still a personal assistant, obviously. But while I was depressed from that, I started writing a story at my kitchen table. And really, I did it. I felt better while I was writing. Like for the first time, this like depressive fog lifted. And so I tried it again the next day, really just because I needed to feel better. And I ended up starting to write another novel, really in order to climb out of the depression that failing at writing had put me in. And so that novel ended up being my first published novel, which I published when I was 31, called Within Arm's Reach. And like five people read it. But I was thrilled because I had published a novel. And then I went on to write another novel, which took me 8 years to write. And that one was called A Good Hard Look. It came out when I was like 39 and like 10 people read that. And then I started writing Dear Edward. But while I was writing it, that book also took me 8 years. But I actually thought while I was writing it that it wouldn't be published because I was what's known as a mid-list writer at that point, which basically means middle-aged and that your prior novels have not sold. So like you're not a good bet for publishers. They're not going to be excited about you. So while I was writing it, I was thinking, well, this is probably not going to be published, so I might as well. I was really loving writing it. So I kind of wrote that book for like 2 years longer, really, than I should have, because I didn't want to leave the world of the novel to find out that I was going to be disappointed on the other side. So I finished it when I was 46, and no one was more surprised than me when it went to auction. There was bidding on it, and then it became a Jenna Read with Jenna book club pick for the Today Show. It came out when I was 48. And I didn't think it was going to be published. So like all the success that I've had since then, I'm incredibly grateful for. And I can't really believe it. It like can't permeate me because I think I was like so fully formed by the time it happened. And I was so set on like, I write because it makes me feel like a full human, not for the publication, and certainly not thinking any success, you know, would ever come. I think I'm in the best case scenario in a way where I've told friends that if this success had happened to me when I was like 27, I would have thought I was really hot shit. And at 48, I knew I wasn't, you know, like, so I'm able to really appreciate it and feel extremely grateful and not believe it at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. It is funny because you do wonder, had you had that amazing success at 27, how would that have changed you? How would that have shaped you as a writer going forward? Because you speak about the gratitude, and gratitude is important because there is so much luck in this industry. Like yes. You say, you know, like the first book didn't sell because somebody's boss went on maternity leave, and that's completely out of your control as a writer. You can't control who's not going on maternity leave or who is, but what mm-hmm. you can control is the writing and the fact that you kept coming back to it time and again, because that is a place of joy. Whereas I feel like the joy of writing dies on this mountain of despair when it comes to querying and trying to turn it into a viable, marketable book, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I mean, for me, the joy and the meaning and the purpose comes within the work. It's struggling with the work over the years that it takes for me to write a novel, struggling within myself, like tiny victories in that I got a paragraph where I wanted it to be. And then this constant anxiety that I carry that I won't figure out what this book needs to be and what these characters need from me. That's what drives me to my desk every day. These are the things that are meaningful to me, the most meaningful to me. And that's why I do it. And I thought that I was going to keep doing it only for that for the rest of my life. The fact that then there was external validation, I feel very aware that it's not the point, and it's not, you know, it's not what's going to fill my bucket, etc. And it's not why I'm doing it. And that allows me to, I think, really appreciate it and feel grateful for it, if only because the success of my last two books has allowed me to be, to live the dream, the absolute 1% dream of making my living writing fiction, which that alone, I never would have dreamed I could live. And I'm so grateful to do that, you know, to have the chance to do that.
Yeah. And it's also so, it's so rewarding to be able to say, this is what I wanted to do. And even though my dad was scrambling and trying to send me to law school and people were trying to make me a park ranger, I was right. Intuitively, at the gut level, I was right about this was my calling and this is what I was meant to be.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel a little conflicted about that because I feel like what I learned was that I am a writer, like, and I am a writer inside myself, and that I have to write in order to feel whole and to feel engaged and to be alive and not depressed. My 20-something self for sure wanted to publish so that I could prove to my parents and prove to the people around me that I'd been right to bet on myself in that way. And the 53-year-old version of me feels I was really right to bet on myself being the complete and the, like, fulfilling my own potential. And I feel really like I got lucky as far as the external success. Like you said, there are so many elements. I have an amazing agent, and that cannot be discredited from, you know, the success that I've had, because I would sell my books for like $12, you know, and not put it out in the world in the way that my team engenders. So yes, I absolutely think you need to bet on yourself and your dream and what some that voice inside of you that's like, this is what I'm supposed to do. And then I feel like I got lucky in other people agreeing.
Did you have the same agent throughout the whole process, or did you change agents along the way? Because I'm asking because of the fact that when your first book doesn't sell that well, and then you potentially have to move to a different publishing house. And then if the book doesn't sell that well as well, like you say, they keep judging you by the success of the last book, which makes the next book harder every time. So did you lose an agent along the way, or was this someone who stayed with you throughout?
No, my first agent died shortly after selling my second book. So I had to find another agent in a weird, awkward time, because that agent wasn't going to make any money for me because this book had been sold by my prior agent. But I've now been with her. So she sold Dear Edward. My first agent sold my first two books that didn't do as well. But I mean, obviously that was happenstance. I don't know what would have happened.
Something else that as writers is completely beyond our control is, you know, you've got to roll with those punches. So this leads to the next question, which is about how much discipline and patience is required to sustain a writing career. Because on the podcast, we really try and encourage emerging writers as much as possible, but we also really want to give them realistic expectations of what a writing career involves. You know, many of them want to just skip ahead to pub day and the excitement of pub day and all of that. But so much of writing is being alone. It's facing down the fear. It's the terror. Like you said, it's figuring out how you can do justice to these characters and really bring them to life in a way that, you know, makes them shine. And there's so much anxiety around that. And there's so much, I don't know if you ever suffer from imposter syndrome, but just can we speak about what is required to bring us back butt in chair facing down the blank page every day?
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the predominant characteristics I have that kept me going for so long is I'm very stubborn. Like, and it's not like a loud stubbornness. It's not like, I don't think my husband would put stubborn in a leading adjective for me, but I don't think anyone else that is in my life would, because he knows me very well. But I just like refuse to give up. And I'm not going to give up for like a flimsy excuse, you know, like, and I'm not going to give up for my characters. I'm not going to give up on this thing that I feel like I need to have inside of me. But that doesn't mean it wasn't really hard. Like, there are years, like years, really my entire 30s, where I was writing my second novel, which took 8 years and was a very difficult novel for me to write. And I learned a lot about process and changed the way that I worked. It's via writing the second novel. And I had both of my children while I was writing that book. So I couldn't afford childcare. You know, like, it was very hard. It was a lot of despair, but I wouldn't give up. And so the piece of advice that I give to beginning writers most often is what I learned during that period. And I think I took the part of this, like, from something I read that Ann Patchett said a long time ago. But there were periods when I was writing my second novel where I had two small kids and I had like a job and I just had no time and I had no energy and I wasn't sleeping well and all this stuff. And I would make a deal with myself that I had to write for 5 minutes a day. And once I wrote for 5 minutes, I would put an X on my calendar. And my only job was to string together as many X's as possible. And obviously a lot of those days I would write for more than 5 minutes, but I could always do 5 minutes. And that's how I got through the periods of despair, where you just do not believe in yourself. You do not believe in your ability. You do not believe you'll ever be published. You do not believe you'll finish this story, book, whatever. If you keep doing 5 minutes a day, the work stays alive and something, the thing inside of you stays alive as well. And if you do that, you will find that you exit the despair at some point and the work will have moved out with you, even if it moves slowly. So there are like mechanisms like that that I used to get through, you know, like when I was 4 years into a book that was going to take 8 years and it was a hot mess and nobody was waiting for this book. You know, nobody was like, thought I was a good writer even, you know, they didn't think I was a bad writer, but you know, my parents were full of doubt. Like, I wasn't contributing to my family the way that I wanted to, you know, it's very hard. This is a very common phrase as well, but my college writing teacher, a writer named Blanche McCrary Boyd, told us, you know, in college that if you could do anything else other than be a writer, then do that. But if you couldn't do anything else, then it was a wonderful and wild ride that you were in on. And I can't do anything else. Like, I can't not write. So there's been a lot of really, I've had more not success than success by far. And I'm so grateful, like, to my stubbornness that I kept going.
Yeah, well, sometimes the failure is that box of darkness, right? Which takes you a while to figure out is also a gift.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I'm grateful for the failure that I had. I mean, you know, ideally I would have taken like 6 years of failure out of the, you know, 20 or whatever. I think like 14 would have been okay. But, you know, you deal with what you have and you create an internal, part of being a writer is creating an internal life for yourself. And living, you know, having a real life there. And that requires moving through the dark periods, you know. And also, I will say too, and I say to students, which I'm sure you obviously you know as well, like, publication day is fraught. Like you said, once you hand your book over to the machine, whatever machine, small, medium, or large, it is out of your hands. And there, you know, there could be a presidential election that means no one reads fiction for the 2 months. I had that happen to a friend, you know, whose book came out right around the time Trump was first elected. No one was read fiction for like 6 months. And almost every novel that came out during that time just disappeared. So like, you don't know what's going to happen in that thing that you're headed towards, but you are in control of sitting down at your desk every day and trying to make a world come alive.
Yeah. Most writers that you speak to say that they found publication day or everything around it an anti-climax.
Yeah.
I remember reading an article by Marianne Keyes, who is, I mean, so successful and whose writing I love. And I remember her saying on her debut day, she went out, I think it was in London, and ran to a bookstore expecting her book in the window. Mm-hmm. And the bookstore didn't even have her book, etc. So yeah, there's all of those things as well. Something that you said earlier stuck with me, Anne, and it's a question we get so much from our listeners, is how do you know when a book is done? Because you said you spent 2 extra years on Dear Edward just because you wanted that time with it and you were just, it was, you know, just didn't want to put it out into the world yet. Do you feel like in those 2 years you really elevated the book, or do you feel like that was more procrastination, emotional procrastination?
Yeah, in that particular case, I think it was procrastination, because I actually wrote, like, the book ends when Edward is a certain age, and I wrote like 3 years further. And if I allowed myself to really think about it, the natural ending of the story was earlier. So I wrote him like going through college, basically. And I ended up cutting all of that. So like, it's a very clear sign. So it's not like I was rewriting and revising and like, you know, tightening and tightening and tightening. I had kind of done that, and I continued to do that, you know, through selling it, etc. For me, that was like a unique experience though. Normally I can feel the end. Like I feel the book building towards it. And then I sometimes, like, the actual page, the actual scene that it ends will be a surprise, but I'll feel it and I'll be like, oh, this is, we're here. It's like, it is like an arriving home feeling.
I love that. An arriving home feeling. So for our listeners, when you get the arriving home feeling, that's a good sign. It's always great to obviously get other eyes on it, beta readers, et cetera, et cetera. But there comes a point at which you may be just holding it back from fear. And speaking about beta readers, Anne, I read in your acknowledgements that you've had certain people in your writing group from one of the first writing classes you did, and you say that they read your work continuously. Can you speak a bit about that?
Yeah. So when I was at NYU, I took two workshops with the writer Danny Shapiro. And in the first one, I guess, I was just ended up sitting next to two women, one of whom I had gone to college with, but didn't really know that well. So two writers named Hannah Tinty and Helen Ellis. And we were, you know, in our early 20s. And we kind of recognized each other as like sort of type A personalities, but in a writing class. And that, like, actually all three of us had a parent who was a lawyer. We had sort of grown up in, like, we'd all grown up Catholic. We had a certain strand between us that connected us, although we're very different people. And we started meeting. Danny Shapiro suggested to our class that, like, over the summer, it would be smart if we, you know, turned to a friend in class and read each other's work over the summer. So we kept moving forward. And so the three of us did that, and we just never stopped. So it's now been, I have no idea, it's like 28 years or something. And they are the first people who read my work. We show each other what we consider like ugly pages. Like, so they read my work before I would give it to my agent. And I do think, like, that feeling that I said about coming home, that's one. But they're, and no matter what level, I think, I mean, there are geniuses, but they're rare, and I'm not a genius. So, like, I do think that when you're writing, you're in the river with your work. You're like, oh, this is going so well, or terribly, or whatever it is. You need someone standing on the bank of the river who can look down at it and be like, oh, there's a fork coming up ahead. Like, there's a waterfall. There's a big rock. You know, I think that you missed your turn back there, you know. So they provide that feedback to me. And the three of us are very different writers, which I think helps. So we know each other's work, but there can be no sense of competition, because we couldn't write the kind of fiction that each of us writes.
Yeah, I love that. I'm big on beta readers. I'm big on collaborating with other writers. But yeah, the competition can sometimes be a problem. So I think approaching it that way is super smart. We're an educational platform. And what we do a lot is listeners will submit query pages and the opening pages to us with our co-hosts, and we critique them. And often we'll see writers tending to make the same mistakes. And so we generally give them basic rules for avoiding those pitfalls. But what I love best is when I read a book that breaks all of those rules, does it so beautifully that you wouldn't even have noticed unless you were paying really, really close attention. And Anne Patchett does that so well as well. Mm. And I was lucky enough to get to chat with her. And the things that you did in opening as well also broke a lot of those rules. And I want to discuss that for our listeners who are interested in breaking those rules. So one of the things we say is that your opening pages should generally align with your plot paragraph or your flap copy. So if your flap copy focuses on character X, sort of setting them up as the main character, then you should generally begin with that character. But your flap copy focuses on the four Pot of Honor girls, when your opening chapter focuses on William. Was it always structured that way? Was that always the opening? And why the intentionality to that decision?
Yes. So the first idea I had for the book was an image, which is often how it works for me, where I start. And it was an image of a lonely little boy dribbling a basketball. And I had become obsessed with the history of basketball. And when I teach, I tell my students to pay attention to their obsessions, because if you, particularly if you find yourself become obsessed with something that doesn't make sense, and my becoming obsessed with the history of basketball made no sense. Like, I grew up playing soccer. I'm married to an Englishman who is obsessed with soccer. I have two sons that play soccer. Soccer would have made sense. Basketball did not. Often it has to do with like the themes or something in your work. And so because that was the first image, I knew I needed to start the book with this lonely little boy. And then I think actually that's interesting what you said. I've never heard it termed that way, that the flap copy should mirror the beginning. I think what happened was that once I finished the book and handed it in and proper beta readers read it, like the publishing house will have people read it to see what they respond to. And everyone really was excited about the sisters and the sort of parallels between the four Padovano sisters and the four March sisters in Louise May Alcott's Little Women. And so I think that's why they leaned into that for the jacket copy. But there was no, my editor didn't have any doubt that the book should start with William. It was just that he was headed towards the Padovano sisters, and so was the story. And I don't think it would have been right for them to begin the book. It was like we all needed to be drawn by them, both the reader, William, me, etc.
Yeah, I mean, he's the connective tissue, so it makes
Yeah.
complete sense. And as well, you didn't write a query letter for this book. You wrote the book, and then it was up to the publisher to figure out the flap copy, etc.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that the publishers were excited about the Padovano sisters, and that's what they focus on the flap copy, as opposed to you were a debut author and this was your plot paragraph. Something else we generally say is open with the scene. Immerse the reader in the scene for us to really get to know who the character is, what the stakes are, what the character wants. And we generally say, show, don't tell, don't give too much backstory or exposition or try and cover too much time. Just dive into a moment. And then again, your opening scene with William is completely different to that. Your scene with Julia, the very next chapter, is taking us into a moment, Julia's world with her mother and her sisters. And we go through a whole scene, which is incredible. But with your opening chapter with William, it spans his life from the first 6 days of his life until 4 months into college. And I would say to an emerging writer, do not do that. But
I
you painted him in these brush strokes, in that period of time, in a way that we knew what he wanted. We knew what his wound was. We knew what his misbelief was. We knew what would drive him his entire life, what he would desperately seek out. So, how the heck do you do that, Anne, without making the reader feel like they're mired in backstory or exposition?
Well, thank you. I guess, okay, so what I would say is my process at this point is somewhat quirky in that once I get my idea, which I said to you is my idea for this book was this image of this lone little boy dribbling a basketball. I set like a timer inside myself for 9 months. And for the next 9 months, I don't let myself write what I call pretty sentences. So I don't let myself write scenes, which is what I really love to do. I love to go into a scene and then someone will walk into the room that I didn't expect and they'll say something I didn't expect and something will happen. But when I am writing like that, I'm following a musicality underneath the language that like pulls me along. I cannot think at all. I can't figure anything out. So what I have found is if I set this timer where I'm not allowed to write for the first 9 months after I have an idea, all I can do is think, research, and take notes for 9 months. And then when the timer goes off, I get to start writing. And so during that 9 month period, I try to figure out as much as I can about the book and what I think is going to happen and who's in it. And so in the case of Hello Beautiful, one of the things I knew that these four Padovano sisters were going to be in the book. And I knew that two of the sisters were somehow going to become involved with William, the lonely little boy. I didn't know what that was going to look like. I didn't know if that was going to be romantic or whatever. And then I also knew that something was going to happen to one of those sisters that happens when she's like in her 40s. And so I knew going into the book, I knew what was going to happen in the first paragraph, which happens to William as a baby. And then I knew that this book was going to go like 40 years basically. And I knew I had to get to the Padovano sisters. So when I started writing the first chapter, I was like, I have got to get like 20 years into this story in the first chapter. I got to get to the Potavano sisters, but I need to share William's story and how he gets to them. And also, like, we have to get there with William. So it was really like trying to write a chapter. It was a very challenging chapter to write and to try to like not make boring and feel like summary and all of these things. But I knew I had to get to Giulia Padovano by the end of that chapter. And that was the challenge. The thing is, when I'm writing, obviously, I don't know if it's going to work. I'm just like, I'm going to try. And if it doesn't work, then I'll figure out some other way. So, like, I try to hold it lightly while I'm doing it so that I will still take risks and I'll try to do something that doesn't make sense, like writing this chapter. And if it just doesn't end up working, that's fine. I feel like part of the thing of becoming a more mature writer, not just age-wise, is like I am able to make brutal decisions quickly. I don't get stuck wanting to keep something because it's well written or because I really love that scene or I love this character. I try to really be clear-eyed about what this story needs and where it's going and what is best. And then, like, I will cut 150 pages and I'll be sad for like a day, but I'm doing it. I'm not going to try to make it work for another 6 months or something like that. But that means I'm willing to take risks. So writing that first chapter was a risk, and I did not know if it was going to work. And it took a lot of revision, et cetera, to get it to where it was. But I also felt like it was the right thing. So my stubbornness kept me trying.
It was incredible. I remember finishing it and I was like, hold on a second. And this is something for all of our listeners to do. We need to read like writers. We need to enjoy something and be swept away as the writer intends. But we also need to stop and go, how the heck did they do that? And be aware that that is what they have done and that it's worked when it shouldn't have worked. And then we sit and we go back and we reread it and we're like, how did they do that? Because it was technically perfect. We got everything we needed to in a way that we generally say to people, don't do that, which I loved. And I've got two more questions that we're going to have time for. One is, it was only in rereading, Anne, that I realized how much foreshadowing you did in those early pages when the sisters are together and they are dreaming about their future and they are talking about what they want for their lives. And especially with Sylvie and Julia, they are talking about this great love that Sylvie wants. And Julia is being like, oh, you're not being very practical and this will lead to tragedy, et cetera. There was a lot of that. And you are clearly a pantser, which I love because I do not plot. I write to find out what's going to happen in a story and to see who my characters will become. And so, did you find yourself foreshadowing as you were writing that? And then subconsciously that came to fruition? Or was it that you kind of knew that's where you wanted to go? Or did you have to come back and put in those parts?
A little of both. Like, some of it is I'm figuring stuff out as I go, and the foreshadowing will happen, and I'll be like, like, I wonder what that means. But it'll add another thread to like the river that I'm going down. And it'll help steer me in some way because I'm like, that feels true. What I feel like when I'm writing is that I'm writing with like an emotional tuning fork. And I'm like, is this true? Is this true? Is this response true? Is this thing that Julia said true, emotionally true? And I don't have to understand it and I don't have to know where it's going. But if it feels true, then I keep following it. And then some of it is that when you get to the end and you're revising, you're like, okay, well, I know what happens. And like, I think there's some scenes that I end up writing often. Like, there is a scene in the first, I don't know, third of the book where William and Sylvie are sitting on a bench together and they have a conversation. And that scene didn't exist for a long time. And then my editor was like, I think you need a scene with just Sylvie and William earlier in the book. And so I wrote that scene, but it was like a placeholder for a long time. The conversation didn't do what it needed to, but like the deeper I wrote myself into the book and the more I understood it, I would keep going back to that scene and trying another line and trying a different exchange. And very slowly, like, I got there. So for me, it's all a mixture. Like, I'm a pantser who won't let myself write for 9 months when I try to figure stuff out. And then I am trying to follow the truth. And then I also am constantly revising. The ideal day for me is I'm writing a new chapter and then I go back to the one before it and try and make it better. So, like, because that's more satisfying. It's terrifying kind of to write a new chapter. So like mixing those two together in a day allows me to like do all of the things and scratch all of the itches and keep trying to make it better.
Our processes are so similar. It's insane. But I love when you say you kept coming back to that scene, inserting a line here and there. That was the tune, you know, the tuning fork that you're talking about. Because each time you're doing emotional calibration in that scene until you got to the point where it was right. And I love the sort of symbolism in the 9 months, right? I mean, that's how long it takes to grow a baby, and that's how long it takes you to grow your story, which I love. Last question, which we have time for, is you present us with multiple POV characters in the third person close, but we also see peripheral characters really closely through the eyes of those third person characters. So I actually, after reading it, is only when I came back to it that I realized I think there's only four POVs. I thought there were much more because I felt so much closer to Rose, to the twins, etc., that I thought I was in their point of view. So how do you approach characterization? You know, because there are times that each of these characters, I loved them so much. I felt like they were my best friend. I wanted to be them. My heart broke for them. And there were times that I just wanted to like tough love, smack them upside the head and be like, you are your own worst enemy. What the hell are you doing? And that's true of our friends and our relatives. So how do you approach that?
I love going into different characters' heads. That's both like a strength and a weakness for me, basically. I would like to go into everyone's heads. So with this book, because it started with the lonely little boy, I knew I needed to start in William's point of view. By the time I got to the end of the first William chapter, I had met Julia and I knew she was one of the key sisters. And I was like, I need to write a chapter from Julia's point of view so I can go into her head and figure out what makes her tick and what she's doing. And by the end of the first Julia chapter, I had realized that it was Sylvie that was going to be the other critical sister. And I was like, okay, well, I need to write a chapter from Sylvie's point of view to figure out how she ties into this. And then by the time I finished the Sylvie chapter, I was like, oh, these three are the engine of this story. And so while I was writing, I actually did write a chapter or two from Rose's point of view. And I wrote a chapter from Izzy, who's the cousin of Alice, point of view. But my agent and editor were like, that's too many heads. And like, you really, I think because there's so many people in this story, the most effective thing is to stay with the engines. And so Alice, who is the daughter of Julia and William, she becomes a point of view later on because she is part of the engine of the story. So that's how I ended up focusing it that way. I would have loved to go into like the twins, Emmeline and Cecilia's heads. I love them, but they weren't moving this story along. So that was how I made that decision. Every time, basically, though, like for same thing with Dear Edward, I went into too many heads, and then someone will be like, you know, it's more effective if you just go into Edward. And so it's part of my process is like going too far in that way. And I think that's fine. It's part of how I figure out the story and how I find out, you know, what makes different people tick. And then it's, I do think asking the question to yourself as the writer to being like, who's moving this story along? And then being in their heads and their heads alone. It is a good, you know, question to ask as an organizing principle.
Yeah, no, that's really smart because your secondary characters can distract you and they have worlds of their own and they think they're the main character. So they keep trying to hop onto the page, right? But you know, you've written an excellent secondary character when they could be the protagonist in their own story. Because I feel like the twins, Rose, could have been the main characters in their own stories and I would read the hell out of those books as well.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah, I think that's true. That is a good mark of a good secondary character. But of course, I don't think of them as secondary characters. I just, because whatever, in my head, I'm also not writing a book. I'm like creating a world. And so, you know, at the end, I'm like, this is an emotionally true world. And then, you know, my editor, et cetera, will talk to me about it as a book. And I'll be like, oh, yeah. I'm like, okay. I have to start thinking about this as like a structure. And there are themes and things like that that don't come to me, which I'm not aware of, and I don't really particularly want to be aware of until I'm done.
Yeah, amazing. And thank you so much for your time and your generosity in sharing all of this wisdom with us. For our listeners, we're linking to Hello Beautiful on our bookshop.org affiliate page. If you get the book there, you support an independent bookstore and the podcast at the same time. And if you haven't read this book yet, please go and do it. Study it. Get your underliners and your markers ready because you're going to need them. Thanks, Anne.
Oh, thank you so much, Bianca. I appreciate it.
This weekend, we were at a birthday party, and our Francophone friend asked my son a question in French, and he was able to converse with her. This felt like a huge parenting milestone. Immersion education for the win, but a bit of a womp womp on my part because I only learned English as a kid, and I'm still getting my French up to conversation level. I'm always looking for the best tools so that I can keep up with my friends and my kids in their French speaking. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app, and it truly immerses you in the language you want to learn. A trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered. That's Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, Polish, so many more. With that fast language acquisition, Rosetta Stone immerses you in so many ways. There's no English translation, so you can really speak, listen, and think in that language. It's an intuitive process. You pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. There's the speech recognition. The built-in true accent feature gives you feedback on your pronunciation. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. It's convenient, flexible learning anytime on the go, on the app, or on the desktop. And it has amazing value. Lifetime membership for 25 languages for any and all trips and language needs in your life. That's lifetime access to all 25 language courses on Rosetta Stone for 50% off. That's a steal. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. The Shit About Writing listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today. And start learning now.
You've heard me say it all the time on the podcast that you need to circle the building of your work to find the best entry point into it. But this process doesn't just ensure strong opening pages. It allows you to navigate the whole building with confidence, knowing which doors to throw wide open and which ones to keep locked, which walls to smash down and which ones to reinforce as you create a space you'd like to live inside. In my Circling the Building of Your Work webinar, I'll guide you through the transformation of my latest work in progress, showing you examples of my constantly evolving pages in my quest to find the best way into a story I've always wanted to tell. In doing so, I'll highlight the intentionality you need to bring to your decision making, how to play around with point of view, structure, timeline, voice, and other essential elements of craft, how to frame a narrative and choose the lens through which you'd like to view it, the questions you'll need to ask yourself throughout the process, how to circle back from false starts, and how rewarding the entire process can be. You'll also be assigned to other delegates to work with after the webinar to gain objectivity, input, and fresh perspectives as you circle the building of your own work in progress. This course will be run on the 13th of May from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. For more information and to register, go to Bianca Murray and look for the courses tab. Hi, everyone. Today's guest is the author of Advika and the Hollywood Wives and Dava Shastri's Last Day, a Good Morning America book club selection optioned by Max. Her novels have received acclaim from Time, Cosmopolitan, The Washington Post, BuzzFeed, Associated Press, and more. Besides co-founding the newsletter Ministry of Pop Culture, her writing has appeared in many publications, including The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, The Atlantic, Elle, and Salon. She lives in New York City. It's my pleasure to welcome Kirthana Ramazzetti. Kirthana, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on again. I'm so happy to be here.
It's such a joy to welcome you back. It's lovely to have our favorite people back when they bring out new books. So for those of you who are watching on our YouTube channel, I am holding up The Other Latter, which is the book that we are discussing today. Dun, dun, dun. Such a fun read. And there's so much that I want to actually dive into here. But let's start first. I'm going to read the opening paragraph, because I want to establish something that Kevin has done here that is incredible. So it's called One Zara. I should have never opened the email. If I needed to pinpoint the exact moment my life went from forgettable to flaming disaster, it would be clicking invite, Elephantine presents Galaxy Unknown, even though it wasn't intended for me. It was meant for her, of course, but the invitation had landed in my inbox, latamurti@gmail.com, and didn't that make it officially my property? Right, so immediately Kirthana, what you're setting us up for here is a looking back vibe. As soon as a character is regretting something from the past, we know that they are telling this story from some point in the future. They have experience of everything that's happening and they're busy relaying it to us. So can you speak a bit about this intentional frame for the entire story and why you chose that?
It's so interesting that you call it intentional because it really wasn't. I literally sat down, I had the idea in mind, the story in mind, and I just started writing. And to my surprise, it came out as first person point of view, which I've never written before. And she was speaking from the past as if something already happened, but it felt so natural and it felt so right. So I really leaned into it and decided that she would be telling the story from the perspective of this huge thing in our life had already happened. But also I thought I'd do something interesting is that in the latter half of the novel, it's actually in a present tense point of view. So she's reflecting. And then after something significant happens, the rest of the novel happens in real time. And I just thought it'd be more fun for her to kind of reflect on this crazy adventure she has, think about the choices she made, why she made them, have some regrets. And that was just a really fun way to write this novel.
Yeah, so it's like chapter 22 when we suddenly go to the first person. So now when we finally catch up to the present tense. So it goes from everything being in the past tense with this looking back vibe to near the end of the book, we back to the present tense and we go, aha, this is the point at which she's reflecting on everything that's happened to her and this is now where she is. Now, I know the last time we spoke about how a pantser becomes a plotter to tell a story. When you started with that first person voice that just came out and it was a looking back vibe, did you know where her story would end up and the point at which she was looking back on everything? Or is that something that came as you were writing?
I knew the final scene of the novel where she would be reflecting on and why specifically there would be a turning point where she'd go from reflecting on what happened to her to living in the moment and experiencing the aftermath and the consequences. One of the interesting things about this novel for me, I think, Bianca, you can relate to this, and most authors can, is every novel is its own different, distinct writing experience. And in this case, because I sold this novel on proposal, which means you sell, you know, sample chapters and a synopsis. Usually when you write a plot synopsis of what happens in your entire book, it's about 2 to 3 pages long. In my case, it was 7 pages long, which is very long for a synopsis. But for me, it was really important to get this plot right because there are so many twists and turns and plot machinations that I didn't want to figure it out on the page while I was drafting because I'm on deadline. And it made for a much easier writing process and also made for a much easier knowing just all the story beats and everything that goes along with writing a novel. It just made it much easier for me to do.
Yeah, and just for our listeners, so some of you are like, what? You can sell novels on proposal and just a synopsis? Let's clear that up, Kirthana, in terms of, did you have like a 3-book deal, a 2-book deal, and then that had to go to your editor? Just explain to our listeners how that worked for you.
So once you've been published and publish a novel with your imprint, you have the option of doing another book with them, and it's in your option clause. And so your editor has the right of first refusal on your next project. And so you can, once you've published your first book, you have the option of selling your second book on proposal. And again, what that means is sample chapters and a synopsis. So what I did with my editor, with my second book and my third book, is I submitted a few ideas. She decided the one that she liked the most, which luckily aligns with the one I liked the most. And then I fleshed it out into a proposal.
Awesome. Thanks for that information. Right. So when I sit and look at the framework of a novel and how an author has decided, whether it's present tense, whether it's past tense, whether it's a looking back vibe or it's not, I go, okay, how does this change our approach to the story and how does it change the storytelling? Because even though Kirthana said she didn't do it intentionally, it does change everything about the story. And if it wasn't working, she would have stopped and gone, okay, I'm going to change it. But it happened to really work well for this story. Now, had she written this character throughout the book in the first person present tense, the character would have been sitting there, the email would have come through, she would have clicked it open, and she would have followed all these things. But the one thing that the looking back vibe allows for is foreshadowing. right? Because if a character is in a point in the future and they're like, oh man, shit happened from the second that email arrived, I should never have opened it. That is foreshadowing because there's this tension. The character knows something that the reader doesn't yet know, and the reader, it's an instant curiosity seed, and the reader keeps reading to find out what the character knows from whatever point they're at. And throughout the book, there was things, moments of foreshadowing that you were able to do because Lata knows what's coming, but the reader doesn't know. So can you speak a bit about using that technique and using foreshadowing effectively?
Sure. I just know whenever I read a novel, that's one of my favorite things to do is those foreshadowing and those clues. So once you've read the whole story, you can go back and think, oh, that's what that part meant. Or oh, that's what this significant thing meant. And for me, it was just about really being in Letha's head as she is sitting and reflecting about what has just transpired over the past, I think, year and a half. And citing moments where she could have made a different choice. And that different choice she made means different events occur. And so I think all of us kind of live this too. If you're ever reflecting on something that's happened in our lives, you're always thinking of those moments of the fork in the road, where if I went this direction, something different could have happened, but I chose this direction and this is what happened. So that's how I thought of these moments when I sprinkled moments of foreshadowing. It's her thinking back. I'm like, if I had done this, maybe something else would have happened. So that's really fun for me as a writer.
And these kinds of things happen in every book. I mean, if you think of causality and dominoes tipping over in a story, the character does X, which leads to Y, which leads to Z, and so they go through the maze of the plot. So every book has moments whereby the reader can go, oh, if that character didn't do this, maybe this would have happened. But it's so much stronger when the character themselves is going, and then I did this, and it turned out to be a big mistake. And the reader's like, ooh, why did it turn out to be a big mistake? What happened? So, you know, when the character brings that knowledge and is able to foreshadow, it heightens tension in a novel. Immediately the character is able to point out the moments that was like, oh, I should have done this, or this is what happened. But also, can you speak a bit, Kithana, about how it helps in terms of the character's arc? Because remember, for our listeners, who the character is at the beginning needs to be very different to who they are at the end, as they have this character arc and as they evolve, etc. So, you know, we get to see her making stupid mistakes, but it gets us to a point where she's older, wiser, and she's able to ruminate on that.
Sure. I think in the case of my novel specifically, my character starts out just feeling really not happy with her life and thinking of all the reasons why her life is not in the place she thought would. She's in New York City. She's in her 30s. She really wanted the Sex and the City, Carrie Bradshaw lifestyle, but instead she has a dead-end job, she has roommates, she has credit card debt. And so when she gets the moment where she can actually change her life and like try on someone else's life by accepting an invite not meant for her, but someone else who shares her name, as she looks back on herself from all the choices she makes, I feel like as a reader, you can see the moments where she is maturing and growing from this experience and realizing that wanting such aspirations that are kind of far out of her reach and maybe kind of superficial, she actually matures and grows to understand what's really important to her and what's really of value to her, which is really a part of the journey I wanted to share in this novel.
And because she's telling the story from a point in the future, she's even able to point out the moments that were like transformative for her. And that's another amazing thing, because she comes to the story with the wisdom already of being in the future. And so that shapes our approach to the story as well. So I just thought it was genius that you started off with the looking back vibe, because it allowed for the heightened tension, for the foreshadowing, for that kind of character arc. I love as well how the inciting incident was referred to in the first paragraph. So if many of our listeners are like, when they phone in for the Q&A, they're like, is it okay if the inciting incident is on page 15 or 20? And we were like, no, it needs to be as early as possible. Look at this, how Kithana referred to it in the opening paragraph.
Yeah, I think it's important to let people know why you're starting the novel, why the story is starting now. This story could have started at any moment in time. There's a moment where she goes to her first party impersonating the other Letha Murthy. But instead, I thought it was important to show her opening that email and reading this invite at a very low moment in her life, because this is the moment where she's at her lowest. She's feeling alone. She's feeling poor. She's feeling sorry for herself. And all these things make her realize let me click this email. Let me see, let me decide to actually RSVP and attend in this place of this other woman and kind of try to have her Cinderella moment. And I thought it was really important to kind of show a little bit of backstory of her motivation and why, because she's been getting these emails for a while. Her inbox has been raining emails for a very fancy event meant for this other Latamorti. But this was the moment she chose because she was at her absolute lowest and she just decided she needed to do something to change her life.
That's so important what you just said now, because again, the inciting incident needs to answer the why now, why today question. And she's been getting these emails. She's constantly been getting them and she's been ignoring them. So why is today the day that she replies? And like Kethana said, she's feeling particularly low. We get some of her emotionality, some of her interiority. And so that answers the why now, why today question. And that's really important in storytelling. Like, why did the story start now? Why didn't it start a month ago? Why doesn't it start 2 weeks from now? And the author really has to answer that every single time. Right. Something I want to chat about here is the incredible sort of genre blend you've got going here. You know, in terms of genres, it can straddle different genres. And you yourself have been surprised by people's reaction to the book. People have been calling it a comfort read. And on socials, you're like, I didn't consider it a comfort read, but this is great. So can we speak a bit about that?
Yeah, that has been one of the most pleasurable, surprising things of hearing the reception to this book. And also because I had so much fun writing this book, more fun than even I expected. After coming off my sophomore novel, which, you know, was a challenge in a lot of ways because it's my first time writing on deadline. It's my first time writing as an author who kind of knows what the publishing roller coaster is like. So I remember that being a very stressful experience. And when it came time to write this book, I just felt like a little more like, well, I'm already here. I already wrote two books that I love that I feel like I did really successfully and say a lot about who I am as a writer and a person. So now, like, let me just have fun. Let me just have fun writing a book. And it was really liberating to be like, this is the idea. This is the concept. I did it. I wrote it in 1 month. I tried NaNoWriMo for the first time. Yeah, I know. I wrote it pretty much in a month. I created like a word tracker. It sounds weird. And I don't want to set myself up because writing can't always be this fun. But in this case, it was just fun. And I think part of it was because it was a very straightforward story. My previous two novels, there were multiple characters, multiple timelines. And in this case, it was just a very straightforward story. I knew exactly where it was going to go. I had my synopsis roadmap. But at the same time, there were so many fun surprises and moments of kismet and along the way. And so I think it's a fun read. I didn't know it'd be seen that way. I just had so much fun writing it, but I never thought of it as like an escapist read or a pleasure read. So that's been very lovely to hear.
If you had to say what genre you think it is, I mean, it's so interesting because you and I were even discussing like comps titles to this, you know, a while back when we were discussing this book, and I came up with all these different comp titles and you were like, well, what about these? And it could be comp to so many different things, including TV shows, etc. So where do you think this sweet spot is, or do you think the sweet spot is that it doesn't fit perfectly within any one genre?
I'm giving this a lot of thought too. And I think for a longest time, authors were expected to slot into very specific genres and boxes, and readers expected it. Publishers expected it. But now for the first time, we're seeing there's a little more fluidity and readers especially don't mind having different elements of, you know, you could have a bit of a thriller, you could have a bit of like, I don't know, a family story, you can have some romance, and they can all live together well in one book. And I think my book is kind of like, I would just say has aspects of a thriller, it has aspects of a romance, my first time writing a romantic storyline. So I don't know if it can slot into any specific genres, but I feel like it covers more than one, and hopefully, again, in a fun way.
Yeah, you could see you had so much fun writing it because I had so much fun reading it. And you know, I always say if there aren't tears by the author, if the author's not crying when they're writing something, you cannot expect the reader to be feeling that. And the same way, if the author's not killing themselves laughing and having an awful lot of fun with something, then the reader's not going to be enjoying that either. What I loved, and it was so you, was the pop culture references and the fashion references, etc. throughout. So that was something that are things that you are personally interested in, that you enjoy, that you were able to intersperse throughout. So can you speak a bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, I'm a big pop culture super fan. And one of the things I tend to do while I'm working, especially when I'm writing, is having something on in the background, usually a television show that I'm just kind of watching. It's just having that company with me while I'm working. And so when I was coming up with this third novel, Project Runway was just the whole series is available to stream. I'm like, perfect. It's something I've seen before, but I don't have to pay attention to. But it's always fun to be at your keyboard typing and look up and seeing these incredible fashions. And so I love how the things I kind of use in the background and company while I write kind of filter their way into my work. And that was the case with Project Runway. Because I decided this was going to be my New York City novel, I've lived in New York City for about 20 years. I thought it would make sense to write about something that, you know, I'm very familiar with, which is moving to the city, hoping you'll realize your life's dream, whatever it is, having this glamorous, exciting lifestyle, and then the hard crash of reality of when you can't measure up. So I thought it'd be fun to, because my character Letha loves fashion so much, and she uses it as a passport in a way to like enter these elite circles where she doesn't feel comfortable. Usually because she lives paycheck to paycheck and like she's not used to being around such glamorous, exciting people who have untold amount of wealth. So I thought fashion would be a really good way, kind of as her armor and her passport to infiltrate these worlds. And then I thought, well, she needs a love interest. Why not make him a fashion designer? Again, the Project Runway influence came through. So yeah, that's the fun thing for me. Just like I feel like of all my few books to date, this has the least pop culture in it, but yet you can still get the element that I always draw from different pop culture elements, and this was that case.
What you do so well as well is writing very complex characters. You know, sometimes they're the kind of characters that can be so frustrating, and sometimes as a reader, you want to kind of throttle them. You're like, oh man, get your shit together. You're driving me nuts here. But then in the next sentence, you'll be feeling so empathetic towards them. And you're like, oh yeah, I can see why this is so hard for you. Can we speak about your approach to characterization? You know, when you sit down and decide, especially with this, like you say, you normally write multi-POV novels, it's much more complex. And now suddenly you're like, oh, I'm just with her. And what is your approach to building her up so that she feels 100% real to you? Is it an exercise you do before you begin writing? Is it like by the end of that first month, you were like, oh, I'm finally starting to understand her? How does that look for you?
That's a really good question because it makes me think about something. I actually wrote this character from a sort of pet peeve I have in mind, which is I am not a fan. And this is kind of funny because so this novel involves like con artists and fraudsters, which of course are having a moment right now with Inventing Anna and a whole other lot of books and TV shows. But I find it hard to take when you're watching something or reading something and it's just one thing after another, everything is bad is happening. And the main character just kind of has to withstand it until it's time for the ending, basically. I'm like, I don't like it when a character does not have agency, when they know something bad is happening to them or something they don't want to happen to them, but they kind of just have to stand back and take it because that's the purpose of the plot. So with this novel, you know, Letha gets herself in a real bind when she takes on these invitations and starts impersonating this other woman, because eventually the other Letha returns, is not happy with what Letha did, and inflicts some very interesting revenge on her that Letha has to deal with and eventually try to extricate herself. And I decided early on that Letha wasn't just gonna be this woman who gets, you know, blackmailed essentially and to do all these different things and just kind of takes it and takes it until the climax. At a certain point, she was gonna have agency, she was gonna make decisions, and she was gonna fight back. And it wasn't gonna be until the end of the novel. It was gonna happen at the midpoint. And that for me is what the core of this novel was about to me, is that sometimes you make decisions which endear other decisions, like take the consequences and keep taking your lumps. There's a point where you have to stand up and fight back. And so I really think of this novel as a cat and mouse game rather than, you know, in Inventing Anna. Anna just does all these terrible things and people just kind of have to take it until basically she's in jail. And I didn't want that. I wanted to let that to fight back earlier in the story. So you really feel like you see how she changes over the course of the novel because she decides to like push back and doesn't just take things as they happen to her.
Yeah, giving your characters agency is so important. It propels plot forward. It makes them more accessible to readers, because it is frustrating to sit with a character that, you know, doesn't have agency and just is pretty much a punching bag. And what I liked is that while she was being tortured, I mean, I don't want to give too much away, while this other woman was kind of torturing her, she was taking these punishments but turning them into learning moments and to enjoyable moments and to, you know, these big character arc moments. So remember, for our listeners, when a character changes through the course of a story, you know, you've got to see those incremental changes in their mindset. You have to see their world expanding, their viewpoints broadening. You've got to see those little changes along the way, so that as the reader comes to the character at the end, they go, aha, I know this character has changed. And that was done so brilliantly. Each time she gets kind of tortured along the way, she takes this torture, but she turns it into something that she's able to learn and grow from and enjoy and discover something about herself, so that we hit all those beats and can be like, yes, we can see her changing. We can see her growing. Something you also do well, Kithana, is that you have empathy for your villains. There were moments with the villain even that I was like, I kind of felt sorry for the villain in certain instances. And that isn't always true of so many books. Can you also tell us how you approach writing the antagonist?
Sure. I read somewhere, I heard somewhere that every character is a main character in their story. And so if you're the villain in this particular story, you're not going to think of yourself as the villain. So that was what I brought to writing the perspective of Adeleta. It's just like, you have to have empathy. She's going to have her point of view that's sympathetic to herself. But I think what's interesting as the novel goes along, Leta and Adeleta are literal doubles for each other in a lot of ways. They're easily mixed up on, which is why Leta is able to take over Adeleta's lifestyle and identity. But in doing so, Leta also finds some empathy for her, because she realizes her motivations for taking over Adeleta's life is not too dissimilar to Adeleta's, the whole thing that she has going on, which I won't try to spoil. So I feel like the empathy comes from the fact that even though one is doing much more illegal and cruel things, it's still coming from a place of pain, which most, you know, most villains operate from a place of pain. So I think that was the way for me to kind of characterize her. And even I was kind of surprised as I was writing it, how much towards the end, Leta actually had some sympathy and connection with her. So it's also really interesting for me to learn as a writer too.
So what we often say on the podcast is, beware when you have multiple POVs, because there's only so much time you can spend in each POV to develop that character. And so the average novel is 80,000 words. And if you have two POV characters, we're only spending 40,000 words with each of them in their interiority, etc. And so that makes it harder. But in a way, and I'm about to, I think I'm writing my first novel in which I'm just spending time in one POV. We will see how that goes, because I'm fascinated by multiple POVs. I want to see how that camera turns 360 and how everybody's affected by certain things. So I can imagine it must have been challenging as well to come back to just one POV when what you've been writing is ensemble casts. You are known for ensemble casts.
You know, I thought I'd struggle with it, but honestly, I think because the first two books were so big in scope, I think it was like kind of like taking a vacation and trying something completely new. So I didn't mind it this time, but I do miss writing those big casts. And I love a multiple point of view story where you get different angles on the same scene. And I'm definitely going to go back to that one day. But for me, this was a chance to actually really, truly live in someone's head to the point I'm basically speaking her words out loud through the pages. And that was really fun too, because it really gave me a chance to really dive into her character and her thought process in a way that is different when you do multiple point of view.
Last question was about writing this book in a month. I mean, that's like a fever dream, people. That's a fever dream. So, okay, writing it in a month, but then how long to rewrite it after that? What was that approach like? And will you ever try and write a book like that again?
After, I would say like a couple of months to rewrite, I think. And again, I feel like this book is a unicorn. I feel like I knew this book so well, and the ins and outs and the plot and the characters so well. Usually it'll take me a good like 8 months to revise it. And I feel bad to say this. It didn't take that long to revise it, but I did spend a lot of time revising. So it was very in-depth work, but because I spent a lot of time every day in revisions. I was done in like 4 to 5 months. So it didn't take that long. Again, it's also a shorter book, I should say. My other two books were much longer. This is a much shorter read. But I think, again, it was just because I had figured out the plot so clearly before I started writing that I think that was what made the process streamlined.
To not feel bad about a wonderful writing experience, it doesn't happen with every book. Some books make you sweat for every word on the page. And when you get a gift of a book like this, you just enjoy it. So we are now, our time is up, unfortunately. For our listeners, we are linking to The Other Latta on our Bookshop.org affiliate page. If you buy it there, you support a independent bookstore and the podcast at the same time. Kirthana, thank you so much for joining us, and we hope to have you back again soon.
Thank you so much for having me. It was so much fun to talk with you, Bianca.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes. It's Beta Reader matchup time again, where you can be matched up with those writing in the same genre and or time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs. Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 4th of May, with the matchup emails going out on the 5th of May. Because my new novel, A Most Puzzling Murder, pubs in early June and will be keeping me very busy, this will be the last matchup until the fall. Please spread the word, even if you aren't signing up this time. The more writers we have registered, the better the matchups will be, which means you'll be paying it forward to your fellow authors, and hopefully they'll do the same when the time comes for you to register. For more information, head to biancamurray.com and go to the Beta Reader matchup page.